Happening in Phoenix. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks for joining us.
The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them and are not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
You're listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI, 90.3 FM Minneapolis, St. Paul, and around the world on KFAI.org, non-commercial, community-powered radio. Thursday at this time is the Northern Sun Radio News Show with your host, Don Olson. Well, today I have three guests in the studio. All here are going to be talking about Palestinian human rights and justice. And first, we're going to begin with Ashraf Ashkar, who's Palestinian-born and raised in the West Bank, and now living in the Twin Cities.
Hello, good afternoon. Thank you for having me here.
So, get here? What's your background and your family? How does this tie into your Palestinian background?
Yeah, thank you for the question. So I was born and raised in the West Bank, in the northern part of the West Bank. My family are refugees. I'm a refugee myself. My parents were relocated during 1967 war, and their parents also were forced to leave in 1948. So my original village or town is outside of the city of Haifa, inside Israel. I went to college in the West Bank, just being a Palestinian, holding a Palestinian ID, growing up, especially like during the first Intifada and the second Intifada too. Mentally, I really thought that that there are always two separate laws, two separate systems. There are people who need to follow and obey the law, and there are people who are the rulers. I really thought that the world operated that way because, back home, I knew where I'm allowed to go, where I'm not allowed to go, where I can have access to, what I cannot have access to, what roads I can use, what roads I can travel on, and what roads I cannot travel on, because that's how I grew up. That's how things were. And that certainly changed after I left Palestine and traveled overseas, where I saw that, people talk about, the weather, talk about, starting a family, having a new job, fun travels, vacations, whatnot. Like, politics is not necessary dominating your life, because that's how it is for me, where I was born and raised. I want to share like some of my experiences there too. I moved to the United States about maybe 14 years ago, and now I live in the Twin Cities, like you said, with my family, have my parents and my son as well. I'm also a U.S. citizen. I have a U.S. passport, and I was able to visit my family in Palestine almost 10 years of being here in the United States. So I plan to take my, I planned a trip to visit my parents who are still living there. Most of my family still live there. So I got excited. I went there with my son. And just for a little of context for listeners, Palestinians in the West Bank, our access point, an exit point, is through Jordan, through the border crossing, where that if you want to travel overseas or go anywhere, that's the only way out. through Jordan. We're not allowed to use Tel Aviv airport, for example, or use the airport in Israel. Same thing in Gaza too. People, their exit point is through Rafah, through through Egypt, Cairo airport. That's the entry and exit point for Palestinians who live there. So I went through Jordan, got home, and when I was there, that was last summer. So, and I'm going to read this to you. So I got this message from the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem on July 20th of 2023. And it said, the government of Israel announced changes to travel procedures for U.S. citizens who request short-term entry and exit to and transit through Israel effective July 20th. The updated travel policies will allow U.S. citizens without regard to national origin, dual nationality, ethnicity, or religion, including Palestinian Americans on the Palestinian Population Registry, to travel to and from Israel via all ports of entry, including Ben Gurion Airport. So when I got that email or that message, I got super excited because I have family who live outside of Haifa who I haven't seen in many years. I wanted to take my son to meet my family over there. So on the same day, on July 20th, I applied for an Israeli tourist visa on my U.S. passport, and it was approved. I got it. So, you know, then I started to plan a trip with my son. And then within like maybe a few days, I was able to go rent a car, an Israeli car, pick up my son and go through a checkpoint. So anyway, so we got to our very first checkpoint. You know, I showed them my U.S. passport. They asked me, Are you Palestinian? And I said yes. And then they were like, okay, you need to go for an extra screening. Just take a right turn here, and somebody will help you. So kind of I was expecting that to, you know, to some degree. As you know, as a Palestinian, there's always, you know, extra procedures and that we have to go through. So I got there, you know, they asked us to get out of the car. There were soldiers with, you know, with weapons. They brought a dog to search the vehicle. Then we went through an x-ray machine, basically, similar to going through the airport, checked everything. Everything was good. And then the soldier there didn't care that I'm a U.S. citizen with a tourist visa on my U.S. passport. He told me that I'm Palestinian. I should not be here. So that threw me off for a minute. I was like, why? I have an Israel tourist visa. And he said, you're Palestinian. Your son is Palestinian. You need to go through a Palestinian checkpoint for Palestinians. And just to back up a little bit, there are separate roads and separate checkpoints. There are checkpoints for internationals and Israelis, and there are checkpoints for Palestinians only. Checkpoints for Palestinians tend to be massively crowded. You cannot drive. You cannot use your car through a Palestinian checkpoint. It's very different for the other checkpoint. It looks like if you're traveling from Minnesota to Canada and you're crossing the border, the Israeli checkpoint for Israelis and internationals, it looks exactly like that. You just drive through the car, somebody, you know, talks to you, look at your papers, and, you know, they let you in if everything is fine. So I got really confused, and I was like, well, what about this, like, this new law? Like, everything is valid. I have a valid U.S. passport. I have a valid Israel tourist visa. And basically they said, it's a new law, but you're not allowed to be here. So then I asked the question, well, but I have an Israeli car that I rented this morning. How am I supposed to return it? if I cannot drive through the checkpoint? And then the soldier immediately responded and said, well, you need to find an Israeli who can drive your car. You can cross the checkpoint on foot and meet them on the other side and continue driving. So I didn't want to argue further. I decided to turn around because that was the only option. Turned around and kept driving for about an hour to try a different checkpoint. And that's something, again, going back to how I was raised and grew up, I knew the system to some degree that I have almost no rights and I need to navigate through this, through the system. So as I was driving, I started talking to my son. So my son is fluent in English and Arabic too. So I told my son, look, we need to speak English only. We're gonna pretend that we're American tourists and we're going to Jerusalem, which is exactly true. We wanna go to Jerusalem, we wanna go see my family outside of Haifa. And I made sure that our English is gonna be perfect. We're not speaking any word in Arabic. And also when I get to the checkpoint, if they ask me if I'm Palestinian or not, I'm gonna say no. Which, by the way, is against what I just read, the email that I got from the U.S. Embassy. I should not be discriminated as a U.S. citizen because I'm Palestinian. It's ridiculous, right?
And all this was before October 7th, last summer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. That was July 20th of 2023. So I got to the second checkpoint. They asked me if I'm Palestinian or not, and I said no. And then they asked me to go for extra training again. And the reason behind it is because of my name. And I could tell how they said my name with their smile. You could tell my name, Ashraf, is an Arab name. So I followed their direction. I went to the extra screening, stayed in the car at that time. And I said to the soldier, hey, I'm going to see my family. I rented the car this morning, which is true. We got lost, and all I'm doing here is just getting back so I can continue on my trip to see friends and family. So the soldier was calm and asked me like to wait. So he took my U.S. passport, came back, and said, "Okay, you're Palestinian. You cannot be here." And then I politely asked a question, and I said, I really need your help here, though. I rented this car this morning. If I'm not allowed to drive the car, how am I supposed to return it? And the soldier said the same thing again. Find an Israeli to drive your car, and you can cross the checkpoint on foot, meet them on the other side of the checkpoint, and you can drive it and take it from there. And repeated said that you're Palestinian, this checkpoint is only for internationals, and Israelis, I'm not allowed to be here. So I turned around and kept driving, and I followed the instructions, basically. I called some friends. I called a friend of mine who's an Israeli, told him my story. We met outside a checkpoint, gave him the keys of my car. I walked through the checkpoint on foot. They drove my car through the checkpoint, and I met them on the other side. And after almost 12 hours, we're able to cross the checkpoint. But it was almost sunset, and obviously things we changed the trip. We're unable to see anybody in the family, but it was my priority for my son to go see Jerusalem. So we spent a few hours just before sunset in the city of Jerusalem. But I'm going to tell you, like, I cried after, like, going through the second checkpoint, after going through the third checkpoint where we were able to finally cross the checkpoint. I was emotionally exhausted. And not just because spending like 12 hours trying to navigate through a system imposed on Palestinians, but also it just reminded me that things have not changed at all since you know, I moved to the United States when 14, 15 years ago. And I'm sharing this story just to kind of give a really, really brief example of the separate laws and systems that that we live under in the West Bank. It's not new. It's been going on for generations. And those systems have not changed and also have not been challenged yet.
Well, yes, it's very, I'm sure that was very aggravating. I mean, even if you're a Palestinian citizen, just trying to get through checkpoints that can take hours and hours and hours, I've heard. But Ashraf Ashkar, born and raised in the West Bank, now living in the Twin Cities, thank you for that. I mean, your family history traces, you said, 48. Well, that's when the original establishment of the State of Israel was. So your family was moved, and then after the 67 war, moved again. So you've certainly been someone who's been affected by all these events. Well, I tell you, we're here on Northern Sun Radio News with your host, Don Olson, and this is our second week of our pledge drive, and we're going to get to two more guests that are here. They're going to have some interesting stories to tell about Palestine and Israel and the U.S. involvement. But this program actually was helped to be come together by people who called in last week to pledge and gave some leads, and everything came together. So that's how a community radio should work, where it's connecting people in the community for peace and social justice. And it's give us a call at 612-375-9030. And I know people don't, we don't usually have books anymore, but I do have some copies of the, if you want to get the 100 Years War on Palestine by Rashid Khalidi. History of Settler Colonialism and Resistance from 1917 to 2017. And it's a pretty good book. And you can get that with $100. Let's say $100, but it's a good report. And plus, last week I had a $500 to kick things off. Well, I have another $500 this week, so anything you can do to add into that, 612-375-9030 or kfai.org. Now I want to go next to Fred Rogers. He's a Carleton College graduate. He's an activist on Palestinian human rights issues, and he's a board member of ANERA, which I'm sure most people have not heard of. I've only heard of it briefly here and there. But Fred, why don't you talk about ANERA, because it's very much in the news these days with its activities.
Thank you. Yes, ANERA has been in the news. They've been doing amazing work in Gaza and in Palestine. Just a slight correction. I was a board member through last October. I served a six-year term on the board, but then my term termed out, so I'm not on the board now because I had been on for 6 years. But having been a board member, I've been very involved in looking at their work, working on their some of their projects on committees, and was able to visit Palestine and Gaza with their staff. ANERA, for people who don't know, is an organization that was formed in 1968 following the 1967 war when Israel occupied the rest of Palestine. And it was formed by basically American diplomats and people who had been there saying, you know, we need to do something to extend the work that the UN is doing to try to really help in these areas. It became eventually a very large recipient of funding from USAID. and has used a lot of USAID money to build, I would say, basic infrastructure, water systems, markets, sewer systems, various kinds of health facilities and kindergartens. There, if you travel through the West Bank, you'll see many, many signs that say, this stairwell, this water sewage system, this drainage system, this the central marketplace, the vegetable market in Bethlehem, were all places that were built and restored by Anira. So they've done a lot of work on infrastructure. And they've also recently converted to doing a lot of work on careers and helping people figure out how to be self-employed and to gain income and to develop. And they work with refugees not only in Palestine, but also Palestinian refugees in Lebanon, where there are many, and in Jordan recently. But the point of today's conversation might be just to talk about Gaza. The team in Gaza is now larger than it had been, doing amazing work, but at the same time, difficult situation has meant that following the World Street Kitchen staff who were, assassinated in their cars as they were targeted with three different missile strikes while they tried to escape the first one to the second one to the third one. So those people who were killed in their cars in that way really sent a message to all of the aid organizations that says, even if you mark your vehicles, even if you tell the Israeli army in advance where you're going, even if you have explicit approval to go where they're going, which that group did have, you could still be targeted. And so it made people feel very afraid. And so for a few days, they've stopped doing some of their work that they were going around with. I think World Central Kitchen has stopped. And we're still able to work with the food that we have in place in northern Gaza in a few places. But it's a much more limited operation, which is tragic because people are starving and they really need support and assistance. And Anira was providing, as well as UNRWA, not only food, but also some healthcare supplies, hygiene facilities. They were doing an amazing program of trying to counsel children who have post-traumatic stress. If you can imagine the fright and terror in children who have now been living for 6 months under bombing and evacuation and refugee status, it's just horrible. And so they've been also doing some psychosocial work with families and children in these refugee centers. But all of that has had to stop temporarily.
So is, with the United Nations, the UNRWA, the 12 members out of, 20,000 or 30,000 were without evidence, as I understand it. The Israelis said, well, they participated in this October 7th. Attack. And so that's greatly affected because UNRWA, United Nations Relief Authority.
United Nations Relief Works Agency.
Works Agency. I mean, they were doing things in all the refugee camps from the Israeli wars that are in Lebanon, in Syria, Jordan, do I have that right?
Yes. They were set up after 1948 to begin working with Palestinian refugees. They are, among other things, the largest supplier of educational services. They run most of the schools in the refugee camps. They've also done a lot of aid work in various refugee camps. And they work in all those same countries I mentioned. They work in Lebanon and in Palestine.
So the, supposedly, President Joe Biden has turned a few screws on Netanyahu of Israel, the head of Israel, the prime minister, and that now the aid is supposedly going to come flowing in.
Well, the quote I saw in the paper was that Biden told Netanyahu he should flood Gaza with aid. Unfortunately, the flood is aid that is backed up outside the borders. There are, according to the ANIRA director, over 1,000 trucks waiting in the desert in Egypt to enter through Rafah, which have not been permitted. There's other supplies in Israel that came in across from Jordan, waiting for the Kerat Shrom, I think it is, entry on the east side. And I don't know that there's aid stockpiled yet on the north, but there's a lot of aid ready to enter. The Israelis won't let it in, and then when they do let it in, they won't let it be distributed. So the aid to the North. I think over half the missions that were proposed by UNRWA and other aid organizations to the northern part of Gaza are denied by the Israelis.
I've heard it sometimes said when they go through everything, looking for weapons, looking for whatever, and that in sometimes in a medical portion of aid coming in, because everything, there's no medical supplies, there'll be a scissors in there, and the whole truckload will be said, nope, none of it can come.
Yes, I've heard that.
And so what's the term? Arbitrary and capricious?
It is arbitrary and capricious. And there have been a number of frustrated movements by the United Nations, by the World Health Organization, and others to try to get this relief pushed through. And I know ANIRA has been working with the Egyptians and the Israelis to try to improve the access of aid, but largely to no avail. And Biden, as you said, was saying that the Israelis should let aid in, but Biden also signed the recent U.S. government budget bill that precluded the United States resuming its support for UNRWA for a year, even while other countries, France and Ireland and Australia, I think recently, have resumed their support for UNRWA. And as you said, these charges about 12 people, I heard later it was 8 people, but however many, were so secret and so important that they couldn't be revealed to the United Nations for investigation. So there's never been a complete investigation because I don't think all the charges have been revealed. And the charges that were obtained, as I understood it from a report last week, were largely obtained from people captured under and then put under torture. So one can just judge from undisclosed terms from people that were tortured to reveal this, what we would think about those as credible charges.
Yes, indeed. Let's bring our third guest today in, Bob Gunin, who's Jewish, a member of Jewish Voice for Peace, co-founder of the Wisconsin Palestine Rights Group. He's visited Palestine in 2019 as part of an environmental justice delegation. Bob, why did you get involved in Palestine solidarity activism?
Thank you, Don. Hello to all listeners. So my story, as a child, I learned from, you know, my parents and relatives and neighbors about the Holocaust, which in 1954, when I was born, was still a very raw, emotional event. And so I was taught about the persecution and the oppression of the Jewish people. You know, my grandparents had escaped from Europe as teenagers from the pogroms. And so we now had a safe homeland. You know, we had Israel. We had a refuge. And so we all celebrated, my parents, my neighbors, my community. And everyone loved Israel and for what we thought it represented. Now, the interesting thing in that story are the gaps and the things that were not said. So, for example, I never actually heard the word Zionism growing up. And I didn't know there was a political ideology that had preceded the Holocaust by 40 years that said we needed a Jewish state in Palestine. And I, for sure, never heard the word Palestine growing up. And I had never heard the word Palestinians. I had no idea that there were Palestinians who had been living on the land that became Israel. This is just something that was not visible.
What was that slogan? A land for people, with a people without a land.
Yeah.
Did I mangle that enough?
Yeah. a land without people for people without a land.
And that was it. For a long time, that was what people really believed and was a motivating force.
Yeah, yeah. I think that that's an example of the kind of the perspective or the prism through which the Jewish community did look at the creation of Israel. And so I think what, it wasn't a big leap for me as an adult to become critical of the occupation in the West Bank and Gaza. You know, I could see the violence. I could see the oppression there. But what was, I think, a really hard bridge to cross was actually beginning to read and think seriously about how the state of Israel had come about and recognizing that there had been ethnic cleansing at a large scale of the indigenous Palestinian population. And we're talking about 750,000 people, the demolition of over 500 villages, and the violence that required. And so as a Jewish person, that's a lot to really seriously think about because of what Israel had represented. And I think that understanding, the more you read about it, the more you think about it, talk with people about it, I would say that is what fuels my activism, my desire for solidarity with Palestinians. And I think it also informs my understanding of what we see happening in Gaza and the West Bank today.
So how is the genocide Israel is committing in Gaza connected to that history?
Right. So I think if we think about the origins of the state of Israel, if we can give that a proper name and understand that really what it is settler colonialism. And I mean, its origin is, you know, Britain had basically gifted, as a colonial power, had gifted the land to Zionists and had actually trained the Zionist militias. And so if we think about the fact that ever since 1947, 48, that the overriding strategy has been to push the indigenous Palestinian population off the land and to make it a land, open that land up for Jewish settlement, that's more of a strategic overriding goal that's been in place since 47 and 48 after the war in 67, which Israel won. Now we have the occupied territories in the West Bank and Gaza. That strategy continued to evolve. We saw the building of the settlements in the West Bank. There are now, I believe, over 600,000 settlers between the West Bank and East Jerusalem. And when we traveled to the West Bank, these settlements are everywhere. You can't drive down the highway without seeing them. They are typically up on the hilltops overlooking Palestinian villages and farms. And they are large. These are not small settlements. They have as many as 60 or 70,000 people in a settlement.
And they're also illegal, are they not?
Some of them, well, from international law, they are all illegal because you are not allowed to settle on occupied land. You're not allowed to transfer your population. So, yeah, from an international law standpoint, they are still, always have been and still are illegal. And so this is really a strategy, I believe, and I understand it that way, to free up this land, to bring Jews in from overseas, to settle the land, and to continue to push Palestinians off it. And I think we see that in Gaza now. I think that October 7th provided the leadership in Israel, which is the Zionist leadership, with opportunity. It was an opportunity to do at a very mass scale what they had wanted to do for a long time. There was a paper that came out from the Israeli intelligence ministry on October 13th, which was an evaluation of strategic options for what Israel should do next. This is 6 days after October 7th, a paper evaluating strategic options. And the option they recommended was a plan that would push the Palestinian population of Gaza into Egypt, clear them out pretty much entirely. And the way they described the operation is pretty much the way things have happened on the ground. It was supposed to start with an intensive bombing campaign of the northern part of Gaza, to be followed by evacuation orders telling the population to move south, and then a ground invasion of the north, and then repeating that process in the central part of Gaza, pushing the entire population into Rafah. And Rafah, not coincidentally, is on the other side of the border from the Egyptian Sinai Desert. And I think in their ideal vision, that they would have been able to remove the entire Palestinian population across into Egypt. Now, that has not happened to date, but I still believe that that's their maximum goal.
Well, the Egyptians seem to not want it, and they're going to do everything to prevent it. And a lot of Palestinians, even though they are suffering horrendously, they are saying, well, we're not leaving this time because we know we'll never get let back in.
Yeah, there is a tremendous amount of, well, they know, you know, from experience in 1947 and 48, that once they leave, they will never be permitted to come back. And that's something I didn't mention before about that expulsion is many Palestinians thought that, you know, there'd be this temporary period of violence and then they'd come back to their homes. They took their keys with them and they have never been permitted back. 75 years. Their demand for the right of return is a really fundamental demand. And as you can imagine, for the Zionist strategy, that's something they're never going to permit.
It's, someone say, analyzing what's been going on, because of the way it's been presented in the media enough, that even though the foreign media is not their reporting, they said what was noteworthy, that this is the first time Western media are not telling the story. That is members, there's Gazans who are doing it, and they have a different take on all of this.
Yeah, I think it is really significant. So there are, other than, for example, Al Jazeera, which has Palestinian reporters and photojournalists on the ground in Gaza. No foreign press are allowed on the ground in Gaza. There's basically a way to completely shut off, from a mainstream news standpoint, what's really going on. However, with social media, with Instagram and TikTok, news of what is really happening and the degree of slaughter that is going on, especially for young people who use these social media platforms, they are getting a very much clearer picture of what is actually going on the ground. And I think that that's helping to move their understanding and their consciousness to their opposition to what's happening, this genocide.
Fred, did you want to add something?
I was just going to say that you'll also see reports on the evening news and in some of the mainstream papers like the Washington Post of American reporters who are given access to Gaza by accompanying the Israeli army. So there were Israeli army tours, basically, for some of these American journalists, which literally are a few hours. So they're allowed to go in by a controlled method. They're taken out of this vehicle. They can't see anything when they're going in, as I understand it. They're inside a closed personnel carrier. They get there and they're shown something to say, see, this is what we found, and then they leave. It reminds me of when the American media was embedded with the U.S. Army in Iraq, and people finally decided, well, maybe that's not the whole story if the only story we're getting is what the Army is telling us. And I think that's the problem we have here, is there's no other story coming to these people originally than exactly this kind of very shepherded, curated story from the Israeli army. And so, as Bob said, it takes other independent journalists who are there themselves to report the rest of the story.
Yeah, the U.S. Defense Department, as they were analyzing what happened in the Vietnam War, was that there was too much media covering things there. And when you had people having the body counts and all the other atrocities being committed there by U.S. troops. So then in Iraq was really the first major thing where everybody had to be was with a group by themselves, and I think with the military, and so with the U.S. military, and so they were dependent on the U.S. military for their safety, but also for a lot of what they saw or thought they saw. And of course, Israel has really gone into that quite a bit.
Yeah, one other piece I wanted to bring up. You know, the world's attention, and rightfully so, has been riveted on Gaza because of the genocide there and the complete destruction of that society by Israel. But alongside that, there is another form of ethnic cleansing that is taking place in the West Bank. And what we've seen there is a significant increase in the violence that's taking place. The settlers have been provided with AK-47s and modern weaponry, and they are committing many attacks on Palestinians, both in their villages but also on the land, and trying to force farmers off of their land. And again, that comes down to land and settlement. So I think it's important for us to be aware of that. It's another form of ethnic cleansing. And I don't know if Ashraf wants to comment a little bit on what he sees happening there in the West Bank.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I wanted to kind of share this to really encourage, you know, hopefully some of the audience here to really think about, like, how does it feel to be under oppression, under separate laws and systems. We certainly had this experience here in the United States, especially during the 60s and 70s. But it really takes time to really process the feeling, the how, like, your brain operates when you're born and raised knowing that you are a second class citizen, knowing that even though you're an indigenous person, this is your home, that there is a government that you're not allowed to vote for controls you. And that's been going on for years, since 1948, 1947. Because until we really understand that there's an occupation, there's oppression, weren't we able to really start thinking about a solution? Because as a Palestinian who was born and raised here, it's hard for Americans in general to really understand what that really looks like, and also name it as well. It's been a record after a record after a report of documented crimes, attempts to investigate war crimes that have been vetoed by the United States at the UN Security Council. So I really want to encourage people to think about that. And just to kind of bring things to more context about the West Bank, where I was born. So the West Bank is like almost, is a bit smaller than the metropolitan area, the 7-county area.
Here in the Twin Cities.
Here in the Twin Cities. Just a little bit smaller. So if you can think about the metropolitan area, where you constantly need to think about which roads you need to drive on, which checkpoints that you're allowed to go to, which checkpoints that are open, when those checkpoints are closed. As a Native person, as a person who was born and raised there, it takes a generation to get out of that mentality that you're a subhuman, because I've been dehumanized as a human being, as a Palestinian, and it takes a time to heal from that. But I cannot heal from that if anytime I go home, it's just getting worse. I need to stop at gas stations to double check and make sure that I'm not taking roads that I'm not allowed to be on. So I want the audience to really think about how that really looks like and why for many years here in the United States, especially our government, was unable to name those issues and problems and solve them, because we have the solution to that. We're giving a lot of political power, a lot of money to the government of Israel for many years. We can put a hold, we can stop that until they obey the law or international law, but we're unable to name those issues and be honest about them. Without doing that first, I don't think we're able to reach a solution.
So it's settler colonialism, and Fred Rogers, you have something you want to add.
I just want to say I appreciate Ashraf giving this testimony, because it's very hard for many people to really understand it. But one way that people here in Minnesota and other places can understand it, at least somewhat, is to pay attention to the report by the organization Amnesty International. I'm sure that many of your listeners are familiar with Amnesty International. It's an excellent organization. It's one of the largest organizations in the world trying to help people who are living under oppression and injustice. And I just want to read to you three sentences from their report, which are describing in ways that people can feel very directly what Ashraf was saying. This is talking about the Amnesty International report, which I commend to you for reading. It's on their website. You can find it if you just search the Amnesty International Apartheid Report. It says, the organization has concluded that Israel has perpetrated the international wrong of apartheid as a human rights violation and a violation of public international law wherever it imposes this system. It has assessed that almost all of Israel's civilian administration and military authorities, as well as governmental and quasi-governmental institutions, are involved in the enforcement of this system of apartheid against Palestinians across Israel and the occupied territories, and against Palestinian refugees and their descendants outside the territory, as Ashraf earlier testified. Amnesty International has also concluded that the patterns of prescribed acts perpetrated by Israel, both under Israel and in the occupied Palestinian territories, form part of a systematic as well as widespread attack directed against the Palestinian population, and that the inhuman or inhumane acts committed within the context of this attack have been committed with the intention to maintain this system and amount to the crime against humanity of apartheid under both the Apartheid Convention and the Rome Statute. So people have said that, well, you know, people say Israel is an apartheid state. This is a fully documented, really detailed, careful 2-year analysis that supports exactly what Ashraf was just describing, that I would commend to your listeners to read and familiarize themselves with.
And just before I forget, I should tell people this is our second week of Pledge Drive here on KFEI, Northern Sun. You can call 612-375-9030 or kfei.org. Bob?
Yeah, I wanted to pick up on one of the things that Ashraf has mentioned a few times, which is the dehumanization of Palestinians. Because many people look at the level of violence that we see in Gaza, and it's very hard to understand how the soldiers and the IDF are committing these level of terrorism as human beings. And so I think this is partly where racism comes into play and connects directly with the question of dehumanization. So I had one quote here, and there are many, the South African case before the International Court of Justice, they had to prove intent in genocide. And to do that, all they had to do in this example was to quote many statements by the Israeli leadership about the Palestinians. I'm just going to give you one, and I think it's pretty good indication of the mentality and also of the willingness to not only attack and kill the militants themselves, but the civilian population as a whole. So this is from former Israeli justice minister, Ayelet Shakad, and she said, they, which is a reference to the mothers of the martyrs, should follow their sons. Nothing would be more just. They should go, as should the physical home in which they raised the snakes. Otherwise, more little snakes will be raised there. And you look at that level of, it's even more than dehumanization. It's really providing a, you know, almost a level of disgust throughout the Israeli society for Palestinians.
Well, how about the disgust that's happening in U.S. society? People are totally flummoxed as to Biden continuing to send all this weaponry every week, not just the 3.8 billion once a year, but every week now to keep, I mean, can he believe his own eyes when he's looking at President Biden? So do some of you want to talk about why it's happening and ever so gradually he's having to wag his finger at the Israeli cabinet. But big power politics.
I'll say something about it, and then I think there's some specific experience that Fred has had that I want to have him talk about. But for sure, the weapons have not only been provided, but are increasing at this time, the same time that Biden is talking about that there's too many civilian casualties. He just authorized the provision to Israel of 1,600 2,000-pound bombs. And these are the kind of bombs that you see in the images of huge craters that have destroyed entire neighborhoods. And yet he's authorizing the use of these bombs right now. And I thought, you know, Fred, you had some experience with Al-Shifa Hospital, and maybe you can speak a little bit to
that.
Oh,
that's the hospital on the West Bank.
Yeah.
I mean, not in Gaza.
It's in Gaza. Al-Shifa Hospital is kind of, if you wanted to reference it, it's kind of like the HCMC of Gaza. It's the largest hospital. It's the place of resort. If you have other issues, you go there. And it had been actually a hospital formed before Israel was created in 1946 by the British, was built up several times. And in the 80s, the Israelis participated in helping to build up the new surgical wing and other additions to it. It really had become the major hospital. I had the privilege of visiting Al-Shifa Hospital when I was in Gaza in 2022. And it was just a real foundational support. Unfortunately, the Israelis charged that the Hamas tunnels were somehow connected to this hospital and there were Hamas fighters there. Remember, in November, they invaded the hospital. People were killed. Patients were killed. As far as anybody could tell, no Hamas fighters were discovered in the hospital. They had pictures of arms they found in the hospital, supposedly. I don't know. I mean, it's only pictures from these armies, so we don't really know. And then they left. The hospital was largely damaged but still functioning. And then more recently in March, they went back for a longer siege, and the hospital is now essentially completely out of business. Patients and doctors were, according to reports on the ground, executed in the courtyard or in the hospital. Patients were and doctors were arrested, and some were taken back to Israel for further interrogation. Much of the hospital was debilitated. The oxygen plant was destroyed, so there's no way for the hospital now to generate oxygen, which is a key issue in any hospital to support patients. So the hospital really can't function. And there was much hubbub early on in the war about a bomb, a small bomb that landed in the courtyard of a hospital, as to who shot that bomb. Now, apparently, Biden and the world is so inured to this war that you can destroy the largest hospital in Gaza. I think it was nearly a 900-bed hospital. And it's just too bad that there's no reference to it. It's just hard to understand where we've come as a group that we could accept something like that. That would not... If people experience anything like that here in HCMC or some other hospital that we know and depend on, people would be completely outraged. And they should be outraged about this.
Yes. And these medical people are working without any medical supplies.
It's horrible. The doctors are doing things they never thought they would have to do to try to take care of their patients.
Cutting off limbs without anesthesia.
Doing cesarean deliveries without
anesthesia.
This is
back to the U.S. Civil War.
It's terrible.
And it's...
It's terrible.
Well, I've been very... I was one of the people who voted in the Minnesota presidential choice of uncommitted. Mm-hmm. And I was so glad that they had such a big turnout in Michigan. And they've had a few other states where there's been a significant. But it's presumably, I mean, I think the Biden administration is saying, well, actually, they've been saying all along, well, these people are going to complain now, but come November, they're all going to line up and vote for Joe Biden. But he's got to, there's a lot of people who don't always think and act that way. Mm-hmm. They have an emotion or whatever that's going to lead them to a different conclusion.
Biden may be leading all of us to a very painful choice. I would just like to mention one thing as we come to the end here, that it's very hard to know what to do, and people are involved, I know, in many different aspects of activism and writing to congresspeople and writing to the president, trying to get our representatives to change their opinions about this. One of the things that we've done in Northfield, where I still live, is to every year commemorate the Nakba that Bob was talking about earlier in 1947 and 48. This year we're going to be doing that again on May 11th, and we will also be recognizing the new Nakba, which is happening in Gaza. So we've read the names of every one of the 500 villages that were destroyed. It's a very solemn and very moving commemoration of this event, and I would urge people who are listeners, if they're interested in learning more and in just engaging with this, to think about driving down to Northfield on May 11th, starts at 1 o'clock in Bridge Square, and join us for this very powerful event to commemorate what's happened and what's happening right now. It's hard to believe we're witnessing the same thing again.
Bridge Square, that's right in the middle of town.
Yep.
Easy to find.
Easy.
Yeah, I would like to add also that, unfortunately, the United States, different governments, it never really cared about Palestinians, never really cared about Palestinian lives, because they're a third party of what's going on right now in Gaza, and they have been since the foundation of Israel. The U.S., like I mentioned earlier, could have intervened sooner. There have been crimes over my whole life in the West Bank that I have personally seen and observed, my family and my friends as well. And the absurdity of all this is that even there is some condemnation from the U.S. government now, it's not because they actually care. It's just because the violence and the destruction became too severe for the U.S. government to defend Israel.
Too many people found out about it.
That's it.
And Bob, do you have last minute?
Yeah, last minute. I want to leave people with at least some sense of hope that things are going to improve. Based on the International Court of Justice finding that Israel had committed plausible genocide in Gaza, several different states, including Spain, Belgium, have basically severed weapons exchange with Israel, and just now Turkey has severed most of their commercial relationships.
So some movement on the international. I want to thank the three of you. The last was Bob Noonan, and there was Fred Rogers before him, and Ashraf Ashkar. Thank you all very much coming in for Northern Sun News. And this has been your host, Don Olson, and it's
welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds.
1887. Dr. H.H. Holmes married Myrta Belknap, the curvy blonde music store clerk he'd met a little over a year ago when he was working at a drugstore in Minneapolis. Now he had his own drugstore in Chicago. Within a year, the couple had a daughter, and Dr. Holmes had purchased the lot across from his store. There, he could build a private residence just for himself. He added his own unique touches, a second-floor chute that dropped to a basement with an acid vat and a large kiln.